Blog Talk Radio.
Eastern family, thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Thank you for joining us for this episode 39 from the Eastern Files. The program is dedicated to memories, stories, and articles appearing in Eastern publications such as Repartee, the official magazine of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, and books by former Eastern employees. We have taken three stories from Robert Serling's book, From the Captain to the Colonel, to ask the question, will the real Captain Eddie Rickenbacker please stand up? Before we go into the story, let's hear an Eastern commercial. Today's story is titled The Hat of Survival. It is taken from one of the chapters in Robert Serling's book, From the Captain to the Colonel. He left San Francisco October 17, 1942, on a Pan American Clipper, accompanied by Colonel Hans Adamson, the Army public relations man who had been with him on both the U.S. and England tours. At Honolulu, after a brief rest period and inspection of Air Force bases in the area, he changed over to a B-17 for the long flight to MacArthur's headquarters at Port Moresby, New Guinea. There, apparently, was a clash of personalities the minute he met the aircraft commander, Captain Bill Cherry, a tall Texan who had been an American Airlines co-pilot before the war. Rickenbacker was to comment later that he was a little surprised at Cherry's appearance. The Texan sported a goatee and cowboy boots. The rest of the crew was somewhat more military. First Lieutenant Jim Whitaker, whom EVR, Eddie Rickenbacker, thought looked a little old to be a co-pilot. The navigator, First Lieutenant John DeAngelis. Sergeant Jim Reynolds, the radio operator, and Private John Bartek, the freckled, red-haired mechanic who was only 3 months out of mechanic school. There also was a third passenger, Sergeant Alex Kaczmarczyk, a young crew chief who had been hospitalized in Honolulu with appendicitis and jaundice and was on his way back to his unit in Australia. The B-17 ground looped after blowing a tire on takeoff, and the party had to shift to another flying fortress. This time, departure was uneventful, and the B-17 grumbled peacefully toward the first stop, tiny Canton Island, 1,800 miles southwest of Hawaii. The estimated flying time was 10 hours, and for what transpired in that airplane and what went wrong, we have only the accounts written later by Rickenbacker in his autobiography and in an earlier book, Seven Came Through, published by Doubleday in 1943. They were scheduled to land at Canton at 9:30 a.m., and at 8:30, Cherry began a gradual descent. For the next 2 hours, they kept squinting for the first sight of the island, only 8 miles long and 4 miles wide. At 10:15, Rickenbacker asked Cherry about the fuel supply and was told there remained a little more than 4 hours' worth. Rickenbacker suspected they had overshot Canton because of a navigation error and wanted to know how much tailwind they had. Cherry said about 10 knots. EVR was to say later he had the feeling the tailwind was much stronger and that his hunch was confirmed by a navigator of another airplane that had left Hawaii for Canton only an hour before Rickenbacker's aircraft. This navigator, Rickenbacker wrote, told him he had the same 10-knot forecast that Cherry had been given, but after shooting the stars had allowed for a tailwind of more than 30 knots. His calculation had brought him straight into Canton. Rickenbacker informed Cherry they probably had overshot the island and suggested they get cross bearings to establish their exact position. Radio man Reynolds asked Canton, which reported it couldn't take bearings. It seems the necessary equipment delivered weeks before hadn't been uncrated. There was a radio station at Palmyra Island, midway between Honolulu and Canton, and Reynolds contacted it with a request for a continuing radio signal which might give the B-17 a bearing. Meanwhile, young navigator DeAngelis, understandably flustered, took a sun shot with his octant and gave Cherry a new heading. 30 minutes later, he changed it and then brought up the possibility that the octant, which he had transferred from the first B-17 to the second plane, might have been damaged in the ground loop. The entire flight, Rickenbacker wrote, could have been predicated on erroneous readings, and it was possible they were as much as 1,000 miles off course. Palmyra suggested that they climb to 5,000 feet and circle while the station took a bearing. This was done, and Palmyra gave them another heading, which Cherry followed. But there was still nothing but open water ahead of them. They tried everything, even requesting, at Rickenbacker's suggestion, that Canton fire anti-aircraft shells, timed to go off at 7,000 feet, so the B-17 might spot them. Another idea was to box the compass, in other words, fly west for an hour, then north, then east, and finally south, hoping they would stumble upon the island. The trouble was that they didn't have enough fuel to complete all four legs, even though Cherry was running the engines on their leanest mixture and had cut the outboards to conserve gas. Canton advised that the anti-aircraft guns were being fired and that the search planes had taken off. There was no sign of the shell burst, and by now they were down to an hour's fuel, at which point Cherry ordered Reynolds to send out a mayday. There was no response to these emergency signals, and Cherry told his crew and passengers to start lightening the B-17 for a ditching. Captain Eddie, limping on his cane, went back to the tail with Sergeant Kaczmarzyk and began throwing out everything that wasn't bolted to the airframe, including Captain Eddie's expensive Burberry coat he had purchased in England, the suitcase EAL employees had given him for Christmas 2 years before, and his briefcase were thrown overboard. Carton of cigarettes out of the suitcase before dumping it, putting three packs in his pocket, and distributing the rest to his plane mates. When Adamson suggested that they should drink all the water they could before the ditching, Eddie Rickenbacker said, "No, they need it more. They might need it more later." They tossed out everything but two mattresses they needed to help cushion the shock of ditching, and various emergency supplies such as water, thermos jugs with coffee, and food rations. Most of them took off their shoes, and some even removed their trousers. But Rickenbacker stayed fully clothed and kept on his special high-top shoes, which he was required to wear after the Atlanta aircraft accident. They donned their Mae West life jackets and waited for Cherry to ditch, one of the riskiest procedures any pilot can face. There was a heavy swell below, and this made the ditching even tougher. The trick was to descend parallel to the swell and land in the trough, using the swell to reduce speed and lessen impact, for hitting water at high speed is worse than colliding with concrete. But Cherry timed the landing perfectly and with incredible precision. The shock, nevertheless, was violent. Adamson hurt his neck and back, and Reynolds smashed his face against the radio panel. But the already crippled Rickenbacker was just shaken up. Private Bartek managed to get three rafts released, and the B-17, filling rapidly with water, was abandoned. Cherry, Whitaker, and Reynolds climbed into one raft. Rickenbacker, Adamson, and Bartek occupied the second, and DeAngelis and Sergeant Alex, he had told Captain Eddie not to bother trying to pronounce his last name, were in the third. A sudden breeze blew the rafts away from the sinking plane, at which point the survivors discovered that all rations, including water and coffee, had been left aboard. They debated going back aboard to salvage it, but decided against it because the aircraft might sink at any moment, which was a mistake because the B-17 stayed afloat for another 6 minutes. The rafts themselves were half full of water, and Rickenbacker began bailing theirs out with the old gray felt hat he always carried. No one, including Adelaide Rickenbacker, had ever been able to talk him into buying a new hat. The cane he threw overboard, explaining that the Lord never taught me to walk on water with it. They were staying in those rafts for 22 days of torture, suffering, near starvation, and in one tragic case, death. Young Sergeant Alex died on the 14th day of the ordeal. He had begun to flight still in a weakened condition from the surgery and jaundice. He had swallowed seawater getting into the raft after ditching, and his constitution was just not strong enough to sustain him. At one point, Captain Eddie held him in his arms, trying to warm the boy's shivering, emaciated body. Most accounts, including Rickenbacker's, claim it was he who took command almost from the first moments after Cherry's brilliant ditching to the day they were rescued. Time described him as the flotilla's Captain Bligh. Still dressed in his business suit, he cajoled, comforted, taunted, scolded, and led them in prayer, although Adamson was the ranking officer and Cherry had been the aircraft commander. The only food in the raft consisted of four oranges, which Cherry had stuffed into his leather flight jacket. Rickenbacker had taken a Hershey bar off the plane, and Sergeant Alex had a half dozen chocolate bars, but the salt water had made the candy inedible. It also had ruined the cigarettes. They had no water for 8 days until it rained, and they managed to catch the precious moisture in whatever was handy. Bailing buckets, EVR's ancient hat, canvas, clothing, and even handkerchiefs. The rain came in a vicious squall that almost cost lives, even as it provided the life-saving water they needed, for it flipped over Cherry's raft. Rickenbacker himself was to say he always wondered how Cherry, Whitaker, and Reynolds mustered the strength to get the raft righted and haul themselves back in. Until they encountered the squall, their only liquid and food came from the oranges, which Rickenbacker doled out. Not until the fifth day was the third orange divided among eight men, and the last one was consumed the next day, because Captain Eddie figured it was the only way to keep Sergeant Alex alive. They were haunted by culinary memories of things they had taken so much for granted. Reynolds kept talking about soda pop, and Cherry swore that if he ever got back, he was going to gorge himself on chocolate ice cream. Rickenbacker, for reasons he couldn't explain, began thinking of chocolate malted milk, something he hadn't tasted for 25 years. Tempers flared under tension, jostling a raft mate, stinging with sunburn was enough to touch off cursing. Rickenbacker, as a self-appointed leader, became a natural target for a kind of sullen hatred. Yet after they were rescued, most of them said it was his strong willpower that had kept them alive. One man tried to commit suicide. To make more room in the crowded raft, Rickenbacker hauled him back into the raft and cursed him for cowardice. When he heard someone praying for death, Captain Rickenbacker and Captain Eddie lashed him with invectives. Long before they were rescued, some of them were swearing they'd stay alive just to get even with the old son of a bitch. And at least one man reportedly never stopped hating him, Bill Cherry, the aircraft commander. The man who commanded the ill-fated B-17 returned to America after the war and became a respected senior captain, retiring at the mandatory age of 60 then. Through the years, he has adamantly refused to be interviewed about the raft ordeal, talk about Rickenbacker in any way whatsoever, or, according to pilots who flew with him, even discuss the events of those 22 terrible days. You couldn't even mention the name Rickenbacker to him. One of his closest friends says, "I think Bill Cherry will go to his grave carrying inside of him his own version of what happened in that plane and on those rafts." If you brought up the subject, he'd just walk away. Someone who knows him pretty well had a theory that Rickenbacker may have been the one who got them lost over the Pacific by getting panicky when they had trouble finding Canton and issuing the wrong orders. But that was to be classed as scuttlebutt, and I never heard Bill himself say anything like that. Even if Cherry or any of the others on the rafts were justified in hating Captain Eddie, their feelings and emotions about his guidance had to have been affected by this ordeal. Certainly the evidence points to his powerful leadership, his indomitable will, and to the courage that had to spring from his faith in God. The Rickenbackers and the Pattons of this world can inspire hatred, but they can also inspire men to do things of which they had never dreamed themselves capable. The famous seagull incident occurred on the eighth day. Rickenbacker was dozing when the gull suddenly landed on his hat. Instinctively, he grabbed the bird, wrung its neck, and calmly defeathered it, carving up the body, dividing the raw, stringy, fishy-tasting meat into equal shares, and saving only the intestines, which provided fishing bait. They weren't out of trouble yet, of course. The rainwater was finished the night before Sergeant Alex died, and they went another 48 hours suffering horribly from thirst. A fish was caught on the ninth day. It was to last for a long time. They lost the lines and hooks trying for more, and they found they couldn't even eat the one that they had caught. It was a small shark, and even hunger pangs weren't enough to overcome the foul, rancid taste of shark meat. All they could do was chew a little bit of the shark and then spit it out, gagging. Sharks were constant and unwelcome companions, coming up under the rafts and jolting them so hard they would be raised out of the water. Another enemy was the salt water, corroding watches, compass needles, and even the Army automatics Cherry, Whitaker, and Adams carried. They had tried to shoot seagulls with them, but the quick corrosion froze the guns, mechanisms, and they finally were thrown overboard. Physically, Adamson was in the worst shape of those who survived. His ditching injuries were extremely painful, and these were aggravated by saltwater sores and blistering sunburn over almost his entire body. The miracle man was Rickenbacker, whose already battered frame grew thinner and thinner until he achieved the appearance of a living skeleton, and his prominent nose took on the shape of a big meat hook. By the 15th day, they were all cursing each other and at Rickenbacker more than anyone else. The rafts were roped together, and it was only too easy to hear what was being said. "You're the meanest, most cantankerous son of a bitch who ever lived," one man swore at him. EBR heard another tell a companion, I swear I'll live so I can have the pleasure of burying that old bastard at sea." The only moments of calmness, even lucidity, came at night when they prayed together, taking turns reading out of a Bible Bartek had brought off the plane. Yet even the prayers led to bitterness, mostly directed toward Captain Eddie. As the days and nights passed and hopes for rescue faded, some of the men questioned the existence of a God they felt had abandoned them, and such sentiments were enough to stir angry rebuttals and recriminations from Rickenbacker, whose devoutness never wavered. They all dreamed fitfully of rich foods, homes, loved ones, and the days when pain had been nothing more than a mild toothache. The dreams became nightmares when they awoke to the realities of slow death in cramped rubber coffins. Rickenbacker's raft held three men in a space less than 7 feet long and a little more than 2 feet wide, and one of the other rafts was even smaller. On the 17th day, overcast with the sea running rough, Cherry heard the sound of an airplane engine. They began shouting when they saw the plane, a single engine scouting seaplane too far away to spot, the seven men yelling and waving their arms. The letdown and demoralizing, but at least it had been the first sign of human life they had seen for 2.5 weeks. A ship had to be close by, or perhaps even land. The next afternoon, two more aircraft were seen in the distance, but flew away without spotting them. On the 19th day, the same frustration. Four aircraft appeared with identical results. The rafts were a bright yellow, but were so small that a plane had to be virtually on top of them to see anything. It was at this point that Rickenbacker and Cherry had their most serious confrontation. Jerry wanted to take the smallest raft and try to make land by himself, putting DeAngelis into one of the two larger boats. DeAngelis alone since Sergeant Alex's death was objecting, and Captain Eddie sided with him after Cherry, and there was no use in staying together. "You're crazy," Rickenbacker rasped to Cherry. "You don't know what direction to take. Those planes we saw came from the north, south, east, and west. And if they couldn't see three rafts bunched together, how the hell are they going to spot just one? I think our only hope is to scatter," Cherry insisted. "I'll give us two chances to be seen. It'll give us two chances to be seen instead of only one. But I won't go unless you agree it's right." "It's wrong," Rickenbacker snapped back. "But I don't see any use in prolonging the argument." DeAngelis got into the raft holding Whitaker and Reynolds, the latter so weak he couldn't hardly speak. Cherry, alone in the smallest boat, drifted away. As he disappeared from sight, Rickenbacker heard DeAngelis and Whitaker murmuring that maybe Cherry was right about splitting up, and the captain blew his top. Some angry words were spoken before fatigue set itself into the argument. Even Captain Eddie lacked the strength to carry it on, and when Whitaker and DeAngelis said they would take off on their own, as Cherry had done, he told them to go ahead. Rickenbacker watched gloomily as the second raft faded from view. He was now alone with Adamson and Bartek, both more dead than alive, and for the first time he began to doubt their chances for being saved. They had drinkable water, laboriously gathered from the occasional rain squalls they had encountered, and before the raft split up, the survivors had been able to scoop up with their hands some small sardine-like fish they found swimming close to the surface. But Rickenbacker knew that every man's condition was steadily weakening. When he doled out the morning ration of water, the equivalent of a whiskey jigger, his two companions were almost too weak to raise their heads to drink. He just about gave up hope the afternoon of the 21st day when two more planes appeared and flew by only a couple of hundred yards away without seeing them. By this time, Captain Eddie was the only one with enough strength to wave, and he had to do so this while sitting down. That was their last chance, he thought. The miracle happened 30 minutes later. Two aircraft came out of the sun and headed straight for the bobbing raft, one flying so close that Rickenbacker saw the pilot waving and swore he also could see him smiling. The planes flew off, but other aircraft appeared just before the sun went down, and a seaplane picked them up. The pilot was Lieutenant W.F. Eady, and he told Rickenbacker that Cherry's raft had been sighted the afternoon before by a Navy plane on routine evening patrol. Cherry's rescue had sent every available search aircraft into the air. The rafts had drifted an estimated 500 miles southwest of Canton to the Ellice Islands, a chain where the Navy had a base. Whitaker, DeAngelis, and Reynolds reached the beach of an uninhabited island, but were spotted by natives on a nearby island where an English missionary had a small radio transmitter. The missionary notified the Navy, and the last survivors were picked up as soon as a plane could be flown there. Captain Eddie had weighed 180 pounds at the start of the Pacific trip. He was down to 126 pounds. When he was rescued. When they were undressing him in the small base hospital, his clothes fell apart. He saw his face in a mirror. He had a dirty brown beard with hair almost 2 inches long and a drooping mandarin mustache, and promptly demanded a shave. He admitted later He wished he'd had a picture taken of the beard, but the impulse to get rid of it as fast was almost as if he were ridding himself of the nightmare. Officially, they had been lost for 22 days, although by Rickenbacker's reckoning, he was picked up on the 21st day. The discrepancy stemmed from the fact that the rafts had drifted across the international dateline, losing a day. Rickenbacker thought they had been rescued on Wednesday, November 11th, but the pilot's calendar showed Thursday, November 12th. EVR could have gone home to a hero's welcome, but typically he insisted on finishing his mission as soon as he recovered. On December 1st, he was heading back over the Pacific to deliver that message to General MacArthur and complete his inspection tour, but not by way of Canton Island. 20 years later, however, he did visit Canton. He and Adlai were returning from a trip through the Orient, and at his request, their Pan Am jet made a special stop at Canton so Rickenbacker could finally step foot on the island. When he got back to the United States, he laid on Stimson's desk more than a report on the Pacific assignment. He wanted something done about survival equipment and methods, and he wanted it done fast. Bill Cherry already had been assigned the task of working with the designers of new survival gear. Captain Eddy added his own input frequently with expletives and reflecting his opinion of current equipment. He told Stimson rafts should be bigger and equipped with some kind of sheet that should be used as a sail, a sun shield, and rain catcher. One of his key recommendations was perfection of a small chemical water distiller project, which became a personal crusade. It was at his instigation that a group of scientists launched extensive distillation experiments, culminating in a practical apparatus, now standard equipment on ship lifeboats and aircraft life rafts. Stimson arranged for EVR to speak to a group of military air officers at the Pentagon, where Captain Eddy delivered his salty views on what was being done wrong. And in the audience was a young Air Force colonel who was impressed not only with Rickenbacker's arguments, but the force with which they were delivered. "It was the first time I'd ever seen Rickenbacker," he recalls. "Frankly, I had been one of the guys who had to implement an Air Force order to strip everything possible off our life rafts so we could save weight. The theory was that if you went down in the ocean, your chances of ever being found were too slim anyway. But when Rickenbacker came back from his ordeal, he showed up at that Pentagon meeting and read us the Riot Act. Every fourth word had four letters in it. Actually, we already had started putting survival gear back on the rafts, including chewing gum. But I have to admit, we felt like little school kids getting reamed out by the teacher." The name of that colonel, incidentally, was Floyd Hall, who would one day take over an Eastern Airlines, sinking toward bankruptcy, while Rickenbacker stood helplessly on the sidelines, his own reputation in shreds and his name anathema among some disillusioned employees and stockholders. Well, that's our story for today. We hope you have enjoyed it. Again, I call it the Hat of Survival, the Hat of Survival. Captain Eddy wore many hats, and this is the first hat we'll talk about in today's broadcast. We hope you enjoyed today, a broadcast from the Eastern Files. Eastern history is being told every day through the former employees and organizations like the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, the Silver Liners and Eastern Airlines Retiree Association, as well as the EAL radio show every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Many chapters around the Eastern system and countries, for that matter, served by Eastern, help keep the Eastern name in the forefront. Remember, if you would like to contribute a story of your own about your Eastern days and in your own voice or to be read on the broadcast, or, as you heard today, a request of your favorite song we can play of the Eastern days, please give us an email and we'll show you how simple it is to tell your story on From the Eastern Files. Send it to host@EALRadioshow.com. Again, that's host@EALRadioshow.com. We want you to be part of the radio show. And until next week and another broadcast from the Eastern Files, we say, so long, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.